Hi, this is Nick Gillespie. This is the Reason Podcast. We're excited to be joined today by Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky. He is a Tea Party Republican with certain libertarian tendencies. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
So the last time we talked, which was a few months ago, you were in the category of never Trump, never Hillary. And you said, you know, this was the worst possible election. There's no good way out. How do you feel now?
Well, I've always been ABC, which is anybody but Clinton. But I've never been never Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think we had any good outcomes at the time. And I did vote for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I got on the Trump train, and here we are.
Were you surprised that Trump won?
I was not surprised. And let me tell you something that really insults me and most of middle America is when the media keeps calling it a stunning upset.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how can it be a stunning upset if fully half of the country thought that he could or would win? It's not a stunning upset. What's stunning is their inability to get outside of their bubble and see that he could win. That is not even stunning. That's just par for the course.
Well, you're talking to us from your home in central northern Kentucky in your district, which is off the grid and all of that. How much do you think that the Trump victory really kind of throws down a marker that there are at least two Americas? There's, you know, and I guess we talk about this a lot in the media in particular. There's the kind of coastal elites or the highly educated elites who live in one world. And then there's a lot of other people. I mean, does this really kind of make that inescapable?
I don't know. I think it's hard to draw, you know, broad sweeping conclusions from his victory. I would say this, though. This is something that I've thought about for a while in the past few days. It represents sort of an implosion of the Republican Party and maybe a realignment. If you think about the 17 or so candidates that were on that stage, I think they all had an uphill battle given the electoral map.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is Trump may have been the only one on the stage that could win Pennsylvania and Michigan,
mm-hmm.
while not losing Florida. And, you know, it's got some interesting ramifications. For the Republican Party, first of all, you know, piety is no longer a requirement for elective office in the Republican Party, obviously. Now, breaking through that barrier required him to run against the most wretched soul known to man, which is Hillary Clinton. So you could always say, well, he's not as bad as Hillary, but he's certainly not the ideal standard of moral behavior that Republicans always try to, you know, promote their candidates as.
Mm-hmm.
He's just more of a regular person.
Even though he's a billionaire, but you're right that he was lying when he said that, you know, he was asked what was his favorite book of the Bible. And he said, all of them. I love all of them. He obviously doesn't know the Bible very well, and he's not even really pretending to.
But you know what? Most Christians would have a hard time giving you exact quotes from exact books of the Bible. And so even when they thought they stumped him on the Bible, it really people said, OK, so what?
Yeah.
You know, I could have made that mistake. I could have said 2 Corinthians. Maybe somebody thinks that. So it makes him more human. He put on a hat that looks like a hat a truck driver would wear.
Right.
If you think about that, it is. In some religions, covering your head shows that you're more humble. And I think seeing him with a hat on his head, it didn't do much for Michael Dukakis, but I think it helped Trump sort of connect with everyday people. But here's why it's important, what I just said about the sort of religious test for candidates being gone. A lot of Republicans have been elected by thumping the Bible. And then when they get elected, you find out that they don't adhere to any of the conservative principles that are within the Republican Party. So I think that's an interesting thing to note. The other thing is there has been a religion in the Republican Party, and it's called free trade. And if you did anything to question some of the trade deals, you immediately got branded as a protectionist, kind of like, you know, people like to brand maybe me and Rand Paul as isolationists when you say no, non-interventionists. Or you're a climate denier if you don't buy into anthropogenic climate change. There's always sort of been that holier than thou, you're a protectionist if you start talking about the rules of trade within libertarian circles or Republican circles. And certainly Trump put Pennsylvania and Michigan and captured Ohio, the Rust Belt, if you will, by talking about this issue and challenging some of those assumptions. So I think there is, you know, isn't it interesting how the elections always come out like 51-49 in the in the popular vote?
Oh, if even, yeah. And well, it's clear we seem to be, you know, in an exhausted age where it's clear that, you know, what he was saying about trade was not fundamentally different than what Hillary Clinton was saying. Whether she believed something different is an open question. But the official, you know, Bernie Sanders was also popular by questioning free trade. I mean, will you go with Trump in terms of renegotiating something like NAFTA and or TPP?
So when I was at the Republican National Convention, I heard his speech and I heard him say, sort of call out the World Trade Organization, and something there spoke to me because last year in Congress, they came to us and said that the World Trade Organization had told us that we had to repeal country of origin labeling for beef and pork. And so I was one of the few people in Congress that said, now, hold on a second. Who is the World Trade Organization to tell us what we can and can't do with our own laws here in this country? So, you know, we've got labeling for cars and shoes, and your iPhone is labeled country of origin, but now you can't label food. It can't be required to be labeled in this country because the World Trade Organization said that. Now, and that goes back, I researched it, it goes back to GATT, which was about the same time as NAFTA. And so maybe that wasn't such a good trade agreement. Maybe it's Trump would say it was a bad deal if it required me as a congressman to defer to an international organization when it comes to food safety in our own country. And so, but when I argued this point, you know, it was like, heretic, it's a witch, he's a protectionist, you know, and that's, maybe Trump's going to change that. Maybe he'll go further than that. I don't know, but we'll see.
Well, are you, do you feel like you'll be able to work with Trump to advance an agenda that is both, you know, pushes economic prosperity as well as kind of individual freedom and economic freedom?
Well, you know, you can't have freedom if you've got perpetual war, and you certainly can't have fiscal conservatism. So I think that we're more likely to stay out of international conflicts with Donald Trump as president than we would be with Hillary Clinton and maybe with Barack Obama. So I'm optimistic there. I'm not so optimistic on the civil liberties side of things. But I do have a glimmer of hope there because he's given us a list of judges for the Supreme Court who he says will be constitutionalists. And a lot of these issues end up in front of the Supreme Court. So, again, I think we'll have a better chance there than we would have if Obama had made the appointment or if, say, Hillary Clinton had made the appointment.
What about with Obamacare? I mean, he has made it a centerpiece to say, you know what, we're gonna repeal that and we're gonna replace it with something better. Do you think he'll follow through on that? And of the plans that the Republicans have been talking about, do you think he'll go with the one that is closer to free markets, kind of a health savings account plan on steroids?
I think there are a couple things that Trump has to do. And if he doesn't do these things, or if Congress gets in the way of him doing these things, the next stage will be pitchforks and torches in Washington, D.C. One of those is repeal and replace Obamacare. I don't know which version of the replacement he would suggest or that we'll end up with. But I think in broad strokes, you're going to have to repeal and replace Obamacare, or the American people are going to be even more frustrated than they were when they elected Trump. The other thing I think is going to be interesting to see is I think he's got to start building a wall. He's got a mandate there. In fact, I think part of the reason, this is my conspiracy side coming out, that they keep showing Trump at 279 electoral votes instead of the greater than 300, which he most certainly has, is they don't want to concede he has a mandate for anything, like repealing and replacing Obamacare or building a wall or some of the other.
How do you feel about the wall? Because, and obviously the wall is a physical thing, but it's also it's a stand-in for saying we're going to control our borders in a more forceful way. Is that good or bad? I mean, in terms of immigration flow, we reached peak Mexican sometime around 2007, 2008. Mexicans stopped coming here net when the economy dried up. Is the wall problematic to you in any way, or that kind of approach to immigration?
I think you have to have some semblance of law and order. And you can't have open borders if you've got a welfare state where anybody can sign up for it. So, and really, it almost doesn't even matter what I think on this. He said he was going to build a wall. He got elected with over 300 electoral votes. And I think it's going to start happening, or else some people are going to be very upset.
Yeah. What you had mentioned before that the kind of what he showed was the Republican Party had broken down. What do you see? You know, there is a libertarian wing or a libertarian cadre of the Republican Party. Where do people like yourself, people like Rand Paul, who won re-election quite easily as a senator from Kentucky, where do you end up going? Who are there more of you in Congress now? Are there fewer? Do you feel like you're more powerful, less powerful? Where do you see yourself?
Well, let me give you an update in a week after I've got a chance to meet the folks that have just recently been elected. Mm-hmm. I think we're holding the line. And here's something that I hope people will keep in mind. November 8th wasn't an election of a monarch. It was the election of a third, the head of a third of our government as envisioned by our founding fathers. And the congressional and Senate elections, those aren't court jesters to serve at the behest of the monarch. We are supposed to be a co-equal branch of government, the legislative branch. And what we've seen is an erosion, even with George Bush and then with Barack Obama, of the legislative branch's powers. So I myself, and I think I'm probably speaking for the other folks that are considered conservative or libertarian, believe that we need to restore the integrity of the institution of the House of Representatives. And we've got to get away from going to the White House saying, okay, what will you accept? And then coming back and forcing that on 435 members of Congress. And when they can't get that outcome in a regular order appropriations process, ending up with an omnibus bill.
Right.
We've got to get away with that. Otherwise, we're just empowering the executive branch and a few members of Congress.
Do you feel, because that's one of the things that is interesting about Trump is that his spending plan, it increases government spending on certain things. And strangely, even though he seems to be non-interventionist, he is, you know, talking about spending more money on defense and on the military budget, but he really undercuts taxes. If his tax plan goes through, he's going to be adding something like more than $5 trillion to the national debt as projected over the next 10 years. Is he fiscally responsible, or is he kind of living in a supply-side dream world where he's going to increase spending a bit and cut taxes a lot and then say, it's okay because it'll all come out even in the end? And how would you, as a fiscal conservative and also as somebody who has been totally correct in insisting that we get back to a regular budget process and an appropriations process, are you comfortable with the way he's talking about going about spending?
Well, if the scenario of regular order that I described to you were actually in place, and if Republicans were actually fiscal conservatives, it wouldn't matter who we elected as president, because the power of the purse resides in Congress. Now, given that's not the situation, given that for at least two decades, Congress has deferred to the president on spending issues, and if anything, has only increased spending, I'm very concerned about the combination of Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and the implications for our national debt.
Do you see Paul Ryan still being speaker? You've got an election within the House, right, coming up for that?
Yeah, in just a few days, there'll be the nomination of the speaker, and then the constitutional election will happen on January 3rd. Mm-hmm. Presently, Paul Ryan does not have my vote. Mm-hmm. And I've said very publicly there are some things that we need to do. For instance, we shouldn't go on vacation in August for 5 weeks unless we've done 12 separate appropriations bills. Otherwise, we're just setting ourselves up for an omnibus right before Christmas.
Right.
So the next speaker needs to insist that we don't take vacations unless we do a budget and do appropriations bills. The next speaker needs to make good on the failed promise that we'll have time to read the bills. The next speaker needs to let Congress debate whether we should be involved in all these military conflicts. We've got a constitutional crisis right now, thanks to John Boehner and thanks to Paul Ryan, where we're involved in military conflicts around the globe that have not been authorized by Congress. And these are not short-term conflicts. So, and then finally, the other thing that I've said that the speaker needs to do, whether that's Paul Ryan or somebody else, they need to get rid of the sort of pay-to-play scheme that exists in the House of Representatives for committee assignments. You're required to go out, collect money from lobbyists, and give it to the Republican Party, or if you're a Democrat, give it to the Democrat Party, in order to secure a seat on the Tax Committee or the Regulations Committee, which is called Energy and Commerce.
So are there other people who are likely to stand for a speaker that you are supporting right now?
I do not know who will run at this point.
Mm-hmm. But you'll vote for the person who follows the kind of dictates or the rules that you just put forward.
Absolutely. And if you think about the four things that I just said that the next speaker needs to support, those aren't Democrat or Republican issues or priorities. Those are just rules of regular order that I think anybody who wants to see Congress function in a constitutional matter has to support. And so it's not unreasonable. These aren't policy issues. These are process issues.
So what is it? I mean, you've been there long enough now. You know, what is wrong with Congress that they won't do this? And you're right. I mean, it's effectively been decades since we've had a Congress or a House of Representatives and a speaker who really insisted on, you know, getting budget bills done in the proper way in the fiscal year for which they're binding the national purse. What, I mean, do you guys need to be horsewhipped? Do you need to be tased? What needs to happen to wake up?
Well, at the end of the day, there are 435 congressional districts, and somebody voted for the people that I serve with, or they wouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. But the people I serve with are in large part very self-interested and want more than anything to be reelected, and they abhor accountability. So you know, when we replaced Speaker Boehner with Paul Ryan, and by the way, I did not vote for Paul Ryan, but when we replaced Speaker Boehner, Paul Ryan's promise was that he would restore regular order. And what I witnessed is there's actually a lot of inertia among the members in Congress right now. They don't really want regular order. They're kind of comfortable having their entire existence in Congress being reduced to one vote on an omnibus bill once a year, because then they can go home and tell their constituents, well, it was either vote for it and fund the military and fund the VA and fund the monuments and the parks and the Army Corps of Engineers, or not vote for it and the government shuts down. So, you know, I had to vote for it. That absolves them of any accountability for the individual things that are in that bill.
Do you worry at all that the Democratic Party, you know, because all of the conversation going into the election and really over the past year or so has been about how the Republican Party is breaking apart and that that's bad for democracy because you need two parties that are functional and preferably two parties that offer real different choices to voters. Is the Democratic Party now kind of in dissent? And what, you know, do you see the Democratic Party as offering a meaningful alternative to a Republican or to a Trumpian vision of government?
Well, it's interesting you ask me that, because the biggest shock in Kentucky was not really that Trump won, but that our state house flipped from a majority of Democrats to a supermajority of Republicans in one single night, in one election cycle. So what that represents is the final nail in the coffin of the so-called Southern Democrats or Blue Dog Democrats. Mm-hmm. Kentucky was the last state legislature in the South to be controlled by Democrats. And so they're still going through a realignment. You still have a lot of Democrats in local office here who govern sort of conservatively. But they're not growing their tent. If anything, they're shrinking their tent. They are increasing the demographics that they cater to, but they're not increasing the base. If anything, it's shrinking, and it's shrinking quickly here in Kentucky.
Do you see any Democrats, particularly on things like civil liberties and things like military interventionism, that you're going to be working with particularly closely in the years to come?
Yeah, I work with Zoe Lofgren on privacy issues. She's from the West Coast, right. Silicon Valley area. I work with Jared Polis, who's from Colorado. He works with me on food freedom issues. Shelley Pingree in Maine works with me on food freedom issues. So there are Democrats who I agree with on certain issues. I tell people I'm not a partisan. I'm an ideologue. And they laugh because usually ideologues used in the pejorative. But I think partisan is really the pejorative. You have people in Congress, and the people I just mentioned are not partisan. They're more ideological like I am. But you have partisans in Congress who don't read the bills. They don't need to. The party tells them which way to vote, and that's the way they vote. And those are the hardest people to work with. When you find an ideologue, that's somebody you can work with because they believe in something. And if your beliefs line up with their beliefs, you don't need to be in the same party to make progress.
Can you sketch out very quickly what are the three or four or five main points of your ideology? And do you think it's growing, or are you, you know, you're there as a remnant kind of holding the line?
I think the easiest way to sketch it out is with one point, which is smaller government. Less intrusive government. And occasionally you can find Democrats that agree with you on certain issues where they do want to get the government out of things. Mm-hmm. But that's the overarching issue for me. It's, you know,
size, scope, and spending of government. You just want it to be small. Wherever it is, it should be moving to a smaller degree.
Absolutely. And you could cut it by a factor of three. And this country would prosper.
What? And this will be a final question for you, Congressman Thomas Massie of Kentucky. What people talk a lot, and I think there's real, you know, there's real truth to this. We're a polarized country that, you know, there are many people who don't see eye to eye. There were many people who were terrified at the idea of a Hillary Clinton victory are terrified by a Trump victory. Is the polarization real to you? And if it is, what are the ways that we can move away from polarization and not move to some kind of mushy middle, but figure out what we agree on and start moving ahead in a positive way?
Well, if you believe we're electing a monarch and that person is going to not just enforce the laws, but make the laws, then it is sort of a terrifying proposition for the folks that don't win that seat. But if you believe in the government that our founding fathers set up, where there's a people's house and a Senate that represents the states, and if you believe that there are also those 535 people in government who are consequential, then it's not an all or nothing proposition. And there's a forum there in those two chambers to debate these things and find common ground. And I think it's only terrifying if you believe we've elected a monarch. So, and government is what the people believes it is. You can write it down, but it's the perception. And so I think we need to get back to the perception that we have a republic, not a monarchy. And then once people perceive that, hopefully Congress will exercise that reestablished authority. And Congress needs to do that itself.
Do you think that Donald Trump, I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, is it likely that a guy with a personality that is as big as his, who talks as if he is God Emperor, not simply a king, that he will be the vessel by which Congress reestablishes its, you know, its rightful authority within a decentralized government?
Well, he's not going to do it for us. I mean, the founding fathers relied on each branch to jealously guard their power. And that was how you establish the balance. In fact, I had breakfast with Antonin Scalia before he passed away and about a dozen congressmen about this issue of reestablishing the constitutional balance of power. And the thing that he said was so refreshing to me. He said, it's not my job. It is not my job to reestablish the constitutional balance of power. And all of the tools you need are in the Constitution. And one of our colleagues at the breakfast protested. He said, but, you know, it's impeachment is such an unwieldy thing to implement. And Scalia said, I'm not talking about impeachment. You have the power of the purse, and it's up to you whether to utilize that or not. And that was very refreshing to hear him say that. So, no, I don't think Donald Trump is going to help us reestablish the balance of power at all. And I think we need a strong speaker. I think without regular order, we don't have power. And so that's why I'm such a proponent of regular order, of having debates, of letting us have time to read the bills, of letting all members have influence on what the legislation actually says. That's why I'm such a strong proponent of that. It's up to the members of Congress to establish that.
Congressman, can I ask you, when are you going to run for Speaker of the House?
Well, I'm hoping that somebody else before January 3rd of 2017 will announce that they are running, because okay, I got somebody to vote for, and there's
Well, but you're not going to run yourself?
Somebody has to. I'm not saying I will do it, but we need change. I would rather give my vote to somebody who will support the platform. But if it came to that, I would do it.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. I think we just made news. Thomas Massey running for Speaker of the House.
That's going to be the clickbait, isn't it?
Thank you so much for talking. We have been talking with Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky. Sir, thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
And this is The Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Rate and review us there. Tell us how we're doing. And also listen to us at SoundCloud at Reason Podcast, as well as Reason.com, where we have video, audio, and all sorts of other news, politics, and commentary.